Welcome to the new State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
I'm Joseph Pache.
And I'm Grace Wan. This is your weekly conversation about where we live.
And what matters most. We are live.
And we are local.
Every Monday night.
Right here on KALW.
Welcome to State of the Bay. I'm Ethan Elkind.
And I'm Grace Wan. On tonight's show, we talk to Carla Short. She's the interim director of San Francisco's Department of Public Works.
And then we'll hear Grace's interview with local musician La Doña.
But first, we're taking a look at the controversies surrounding the Oakland Police Department. In June of this year, the Oakland City Council voted to give the Oakland Police Department less money than Mayor Libby Schaaf had proposed. But last month, that same City Council voted to open a new police academy to combat a rising tide of gun violence.
With us to parse through the issues facing Oakland's police force, we're joined by Annie Shaka, Oakland reporter for the East Bay Times. Welcome, Annie.
Hi, thanks for having me.
So, Annie, as Grace noted, in June, the Oakland City Council said it wasn't going to give the mayor the money she wanted to fund the police department, and now they voted to open a fifth police academy. Why is that the case?
Yeah, it's according to a few reasons, according to both the council member who put it forward and those who, you know, voted to approve it. You know, partly this surge in gun violence that's been happening essentially since the start of the pandemic. That's been overwhelming for Oakland. And I think city leaders are facing a lot of pressure to, you know, increase public safety in a variety of ways. And, you know, part of that pressure has been to increase the number of police officers on the force. That's a controversial solution, increasing police officers. But, you know, there's also this, you know, element, you know, Measure Z funding, they need to have at least 678 officers on the force. So there's been this kind of pressure to keep that number above as, you know, police officers have been leaving in what the police department says are kind of, you know, drastic numbers, you know, more often, more than usual, officers are leaving. So they're trying to boost those numbers. And yeah, it's kind of throwing or has thrown the city kind of back into this public safety debate about how to fund it and how many cops to have and, you know, where to go from here.
Well, you mentioned Measure Z. Can you just briefly describe what that is and why it requires a certain number of officers?
Yeah, there's it's a function that essentially gives public safety funding to the city. It was voter approved, but essentially in order to reap the money from it, for the city to use that for, you know, which it uses for both, you know, violence prevention and law enforcement, they need to keep a certain amount of officers, 678 to be specific. And so that was a big reason why Councilmember Sheng Tao, you know, at least according to what she said, you know, why she brought this resolution forward to essentially fund another police academy beyond what the council had ultimately voted on in June for with the budget discussions were happening. And so that was a big reason for her. And so, I mean, there is some grace period from what I understand if the force does drop below that 678. But yeah, they're essentially grappling with this overall question of how to recruit and retain more police officers in Oakland.
Well, how is Oakland going to pay for this new police academy? And let's just to be clear, we're not talking about a new building per se. Really, this is just a program.
Correct. Yeah. When they say police academies, it's essentially a cohort of recruits that complete their basic training with OPD. That's, you know, what we refer to when we say police academies. And so the resolution that was, you know, approved recently by the city council essentially, you know, is intended to use cost savings from, you know, existing police academies that were not full. So, you know, say if there's 40 or 45 students or recruits in a academy, you know, if that's not full, you know, they do save some money. And so essentially they want to use whatever cost savings to fund kind of a smaller academy just to kind of get some extra people, some extra, you know, recruits to, you know, for them hopefully stay on the force. So that's kind of their plan. And there's also a consideration to explore what it would cost to, you know, just put more money towards another academy in the fiscal year next year, but there's no real resolution yet. I think they're still exploring how to do that. So for now, what's been approved is essentially using cost savings from kind of the lower numbers of existing academies to try to get a few more people through.
And Annie, we know from the election season last year and in the wake of Black Lives Matter that defund the police has been a common refrain among many activists. And did the city council in Oakland end up defunding the police in this budget cycle, or at least reducing their budget?
Yeah, they didn't actually take away money from the police department. They actually ended up giving more, you know, millions more dollars over what was spent. And that came, you know, last year there were some cuts from city administration just due to a need for cost savings and kind of an overrun of certain, you know, like police overtime over in their budget. So they had to have made some cuts. So it's about 38 million. This budget is about $38 million more than what police spent last year or last cycle. And so they didn't actually end up defunding. It wasn't quite as much money, though, as what, for example, the mayor had proposed in her initial budget. And of course, not as much as what, you know, some people, whether, you know, within the police department and then just supporters, you know, wanted in terms of what they think is needed for to keep, you know, public safety, you know, their desire for public safety. And what the city council did do as well is, you know, took some of those savings from the police department and, or, you know, I don't know if savings is the right word, but took some of the money that perhaps the mayor or others would have directed to, you know, sworn law enforcement and diverted it into like the Department for Violence Prevention and some other kind of social services. And the idea being there, you know, that public safety is more about more than just law enforcement, that it's about prevention and kind of stabilizing communities and, you know, housing people and providing people with jobs and just helping people find a stability, you know, to kind of prevent people from turning to crime or being victims of crime or, you know, things like that. So that was kind of a lot of the thinking among this city council.
So some of that money was diverted to some non-crisis, non-emergency sort of programs. Is that right? Is that what you're saying?
Yeah, some of the proposed money. So despite not actually defunding, I mean, the city had actually even convened a task force and, you know, was really exploring, like, what would it look like to defund police by as much as 50%. So, I mean, that was an initial kind of task that they had set up for themselves in 2020. And they ultimately did not end up actually defunding, but, you know, they took some of the money that would have, you know, that the mayor had proposed, for example. Of course, you know, the budget process is such that the mayor puts forward her budget. You know, it's altered, you know, the city council, you know, essentially puts theirs, the council president proposes hers, you know, and that's kind of negotiated throughout the process. So yes, the mayor's proposal had, you know, given more funding to police and essentially city council said, we're going to, you know, do this instead a little bit. And so diverted some of that proposed funding.
Right. And you had mentioned that crime is on the rise. Just where is Oakland right now in terms of crime statistics? Is 2021 better or worse than it was in 2020?
Yeah, it's gotten slightly worse or appears on track to be worse than 2020. So, you know, a major concern in Oakland right now is the homicide rate and the, you know, overall gun violence crimes in the city. And so that started to kind of surge around the time that the pandemic hit. So we had about 109 homicides last year in all of 2020. And we just reached, I believe it's 111 homicides this year.
Wow.
So far, we're still a few months to go. So there is a concern that, you know, about the uptick in gun violence. And, you know, I mean, to put it into context, it's, you know, the 90s, you know, had more of a high rate, you know, I think it reached 175 number of homicides. And so we're below that, but it does come after a period where homicides and gun violence had appeared to mostly decrease since about 2012 was decreasing. And, you know, unfortunately last year kind of, you know, we're seeing this surge again. So yeah, this is all happening amid kind of a backdrop of, you know, gun violence that is really impacting certain communities. And so there's a lot of pressure to do something and a lot of, you know, fear in the community.
All right. Well, Annie Shaka from the East Bay Times, let's turn to another issue affecting the Oakland Police Department, which is an Instagram account run by Oakland police officers that was roundly criticized by top brass and an outside investigator as touting racist and sexist views and mocked efforts to curb police brutality. Can you describe just who ran this account and how it was discovered?
Yeah, it was... We don't know, you know, we don't have a specific ID, but we do know that it was former officer who created the account, according to the investigators. And it was engaged with by Oakland police officers. And so essentially, you know, that came out, I guess, beginning of 2020, January of 2020. The Oakland side did a report just about the account and that OPD was doing an investigation. And so essentially what we have found out since is that OPD knew about this account, you know, as early as September of last year of 2019, I guess it would be, and didn't act aggressively enough, according to the investigators. There was, you know, just some questions about who knew about it. There were certain, you know, leaders kind of within the police department that, you know, saw it, but, you know, either didn't notice or didn't consider it kind of an issue that they needed to deal with, you know, very aggressively. And so, you know, it ultimately reached the interim police chief early last year in early 2020, which is when they launched a more, you know, aggressive investigation and hired an outside investigations firm to, you know, conduct these findings about just kind of who started it, what it was, and, you know, who participated. And so they found that, you know, a former officer who had been recently fired started it. And, you know, in that investigation, I think there was about 10 officers, both current and former, who, you know, not just with that account, but it violated policies of the department in some way regarding, you know, social media and online policies. Yeah.
Well, I think it's worth just for the listeners who might not be familiar with the story to just kind of explain how, you know, sexist and racist this account was. I mean, one of the memes degraded women officers claiming they use sex to advance their careers, while another meme communicated the message that female recruits were objects of sexual interest to male officers who wanted the recruits to, quote unquote, be theirs. I mean, this was not an account that anybody would want to have associated with a police department.
Yeah, it's pretty egregious. I mean, as you said, it ranged from, you know, sexist posts kind of degrading women and degrading women officers, you know, racist posts, and then also just, you know, entwined with that, you know, posts that essentially mocked any reform efforts, which is something that the department, you know, it's under federal monitoring. It has been for 2 decades. And so, you know, the whole goal with that is to essentially change the culture, reform the culture. And this, you know, account was essentially, you know, mocking that effort and kind of flying in the face of that, you know, struggle for change. And so, yeah, a lot of people found, you know, just the whole thing really hideous, just in its the fact that there are people, you know, within the department who, you know, have these feelings. You know, and just the fact that officers engaged with it and that it was out there on social media.
Hmm. And Annie, a lot of critics have called this investigation of this account anemic. Can you tell us a little bit about why they feel like the follow up here has not been very, very thorough?
Yeah, I mean, it kind of goes back to, you know, that point about, you know, certain leaders within the department, you know, knowing about this account, you know, as early as, you know, the September before it was kind of made public. And, you know, essentially what happened is, you know, it kind of started to spread and, you know, certain leaders saw it. You know, there was even a question of they had proposed that it was maybe a trap by, as they described it, Antifa or Black Lives Matter activists, as if people were trying to set them up and trap them in some way, which was, you know, found to be not true. That's not, you know, what the account was. The account was started by a former officer. And so, yeah, I mean, so there was that. And then, you know, once it did reach the interim police chief, you know, she did call for a deeper investigation. But just, yeah, it brought up a lot of concerns for, people just about, you know, how it was handled. And we don't know a whole lot of specifics about how the discipline is going now, or how, you know, what is happening now in the wake of that investigations report. They made a series of recommendations that the police department has said they are following. But we don't know exactly like how some of those officers who are still on the force are being disciplined, or kind of what the extent is. Although they have said that they're making changes about, you know, their various social media policies and kind of cultural trainings and things like that. So it's a little bit, you know, remains to be seen.
Well, so nobody's lost their job because of this scandal at this point. Is that right?
That is unclear. Some of the officers had already left or been fired who were involved. So they said some of the other officers, they've said that they've been, you know, imposed discipline. But, you know, what that means is a little murky so far.
And Annie, Oakland's police department has been subject to federal oversight for 20 years now because of a previous civil rights scandal known as the Ryder case, in which officers were accused of beating suspects and planting drugs on people, among other allegations. So how does this latest scandal affect that oversight?
Yeah, so it could end up affecting it quite a bit. So the two civil rights attorneys who had been representing the plaintiffs in that and sort of, you know, spearheading a lot of the, you know, court proceedings, you know, that are, you know, they work to, you know, push the reform, John Burris and Jim Channon, you know, they had been kind of ready, you know, somewhat recently in recent months to say, you know, they even said on the record, you know, we think that it's time to start talking about lifting this oversight. And, you know, OPD has perhaps come a long way, and they had faith in the current chief, Laron Armstrong. And that, when I talked to John Burris, you know, recently, he says this investigation has kind of, you know, given him pause. And, you know, on top of that, the federal judge had said before this investigator's report kind of came out publicly that he would be watching pretty closely to see kind of how the department handled it. It, you know, calling it, you know, pretty representative of the culture of the department. And so that it would have, you know, some weight in terms of getting, you know, the department getting out from under that oversight. And so that remains to be seen. The next hearing is early January in front of him. So it could have quite a bearing.
Well, there's certainly a lot of challenges facing the Oakland Police Department, and we're so thankful that you were here to explain them all to us. That was Annie Shaka. She's the Oakland reporter for the East Bay Times. Thanks for joining us, Annie.
Thank you.
And coming up next on State of the Bay, we'll talk to Carla Short, the interim director of San Francisco's Department of Public Works.
Welcome back to State of the Bay. I'm Grace Wan.
And I'm Ethan Elkind. San Francisco's Department of Public Works is responsible for keeping the city's streets clean, but for the last year and a half, it's been dealing with its own mess, the saga of Mohamed Nuru, the department's former head who was arrested last year by the FBI and charged with bribery and fraud. Last month, the San Francisco Recology Group pleaded guilty to paying bribes of $150,000 a year from 2014 to 2019 to a nonprofit controlled by Nuru in exchange for favored treatment.
As the scandal continues to unfold, the San Francisco Department of Public Works is focused on moving forward. Tonight, we're pleased to be joined by its interim director, Carla Short, who was appointed by Mayor London Breed and City Administrator Carmen Hsu to the job. Welcome, Carla Short.
Thanks for having me.
And we want you to be a part of this conversation. Are you curious about the status of a public works project? What do you think should be done to clean the streets? Give us a call with any questions or comments. We're at 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255. You can also send us a message on Twitter at State of Bay.
Well, Carla Short, let's start with the morale at the Department of Public Works. Mohamed Nuru was such a well-respected and well-liked city official for so long. His handle was literally Mr. Clean. How has this scandal affected morale at the department?
Well, I think it's safe to say that, you know, many of us were very, very shocked at the arrest of the director, and morale took a hit. But I think, you know, what we also saw was, and I would actually dispute your intro, Ethan, a little bit. I don't think we have been dealing with a scandal for the last year and a half. I think we have demonstrated that the department keeps going, and we're bigger than one person. We have continued to deliver for the residents of San Francisco. And, you know, I think we were pretty resilient. So morale took a hit, there's no question, but I think we've also really seen how the department came together, and the hardworking folks kept working hard despite the shock, and then despite the onset of COVID.
Well, Carla, it's good to hear that the department feels like it's able to move forward from what happened. But you did mention with morale taking a hit. I'm just curious what you have been able to do to try to improve morale then and ensure that the department is able to move beyond this.
Yeah, well, I think one of the things that we have tried to do is really focus on making some changes so that we could show, you know, the people of San Francisco, but also our own employees, how important working ethically and with integrity is to the department. And so immediately we mandated ethics training for all of our employees. We've strengthened transparency and oversight with our contracts and also with our grants. And I think that we've also really focused on highlighting the good work that our employees do. I think shortly after the scandal emerged, COVID hit. And that was an incredibly challenging time for everyone, of course, in the Bay Area. But one of the things that we did is we kept coming to work every day and cleaning the streets. And I think, you know, being able to deliver for the residents of San Francisco during a time that was incredibly scary and stressful. And let me say, we were scared too. But we worked on creating safe sleeping sites for our unhoused populations. We kept the streets clean. You know, our buildings and trades folks were in the hospitals building isolation areas. And I think what we showed ourselves was just how resilient we are and how much we could continue to get done. So, you know, it's still a challenge. We're trying to remind everybody that we are the department that many people turn to when they need something, and we're able to deliver. And that's how we sort of reinstill that pride and kind of re-embrace our role.
Well, Carla, you've sort of touched on this, but for listeners who may not know the scope of your department and all the things that it does, can you just give us a brief outline of what does the DPW do and what does it not do?
Yeah, we do a lot. And let me tell you that I have learned more being in this interim role. And I've been with the department for 17 years, so I thought I had a pretty good handle on all the things we do. We have an over $350 million annual operating budget. And over 1,500 employees. And one of the things that I think everybody recognizes that we do is we clean the streets. We have street sweepers, we have litter patrol folks, and we clean the streets regularly. But we also design and manage the construction of civic buildings, of streetscape projects. We have multi-million dollar bond programs. We do job training. So we have a number of workforce development programs. We pave the roads. That's something that I think people may know about. We repair bridges and public structures. So some of the unique staircases in San Francisco that we have in our rights of way, we are responsible for caring for those. Of course, I have to mention our urban forestry program. That's where I came from. We maintain trees, street trees all over the city, and plant new trees. And, you know, we also address some of the challenges around homelessness and the unhoused population. So we do an awful lot.
Well, and Carla, let's talk about one thing you mentioned, the street cleaning. I think that's top of mind for San Franciscans and anyone who comes to visit. The Examiner had a piece last week actually criticizing the city and the department's efforts to keep streets clean. And we've already got some listener comments along these lines. We have Mary who writes in, "I love San Francisco, but I'm so embarrassed by it right now. The streets are just disgusting. There's litter blowing down the sidewalks. The gutters are often full of debris. I've walked around human feces more than once. Why doesn't Public Works up the amount of cleaning? My street only gets cleaned twice a month, and because people ignore the street cleaning signs, my block often gets missed." And we also have Tina writing, and I drove down Van Ness on Friday and a gentleman was going to the bathroom in the middle of the roadway, left his feces there. The city's going downhill fast, and I worry it will not recover. Carla, I'm sure you hear this a lot. What's your response to these kinds of complaints and criticisms?
Yeah, we do hear it a lot. And of course, you know, we do our best to respond whenever we are aware of a problem. We are both proactively going out and running what we call running routes. And then we do respond to 311 requests. We respond to more than 10,000 requests, and we remove more than 3.5 million pounds of trash from the streets and sidewalks every month. Yes, month. So we are cleaning a lot. I think the reality is that we have a lot of challenges in San Francisco. And one of the things that we've really, or that I have personally noticed is oftentimes the street is fairly clean. But if there is an unhoused person there with many of their belongings on the street, it doesn't feel clean. The perception is that it's not clean. And so we have this challenge that, you know, we work really hard to try to clean the streets. Of course, it's a windy city. Litter will blow. You know, we chase after it when we can. And as I said, we proactively run these routes. But we also have a challenge that when we have a big unhoused population that generates debris, that it is then hard to clean up. And also it just gives people the perception that the city is not clean, even when maybe it is reasonably clean or we've just gone through and cleaned. So I think that's one of the challenges we face.
And Carly, you mentioned 311. Maybe not all listeners know what that is. Can you just explain what 311 is?
Yes, thank you for that. And I should have known to do that. 311 is the city's call center where you can call if you don't know what department is responsible for something. You can just dial 311. They also have a really easy to use app. And their job is to figure out what city agency is responsible for addressing that concern. And we get, as I said, we get more than 10,000 service requests just for street cleaning every month that we respond to. And I will just note, you know, many of us have experienced, you know, feces on the sidewalk or the street. We prioritize those requests. So if you see it, please do call. You know, I had someone the other day who said, well, you know, I know four other people called it in, so I didn't call it in. And I'm like, we didn't get that one. No one, everyone assumed someone else was going to call. So please do call because it is important for us to get those requests so that we can try to respond as quickly as possible.
Well, you're listening to State of the Bay on local public radio 91.7 KALW, San Francisco Bay Area. I'm Grace Wan, along with Ethan Elkind, and we're talking to Carla Short. She's the interim director of San Francisco's Public Works Department. What's a public works project that you have questions about, and are you satisfied with the cleanliness of city streets? You can join us with your questions and comments by calling 866-798-TALK. That's 866-798-8255, or email us at stateofthebay@kalw.org, or find us on Twitter. We're at State of Bay. Carla, you were talking about the challenges of the unhoused population, meaning we're a compassionate city. We want to make sure that people are well taken care of. There was a report out by the Coalition for Homelessness. It was alleging that the department had bulldozed, that's their words, encampments of unhoused people. What's your response to that allegation?
Well, I would just say, you know, we work very closely with the Healthy Streets Operations Center, which is directed by the city's Department of Emergency Management. And the goal of that group is to have really a unified response to try to address the needs of the unhoused population. You know, I don't agree that we bulldozed an encampment. The approach is that we go in, there's a team of folks that include social workers, medics, clinicians, and we offer shelter to the unhoused populations when we go in to address those situations. So, you know, we have often had people accuse us of taking things when in fact, you know, the person who is moving into shelter said, you can just take that. You know, we've had that happen on occasions. And I certainly, we want to be empathetic and very careful. And of course, we're not perfect, but I think, you know, we try to go in as compassionately as possible. And our role, again, is really, you know, we're the cleaning side of that. unit of folks that comes in to try to address all these different needs. And so what often happens is we're the ones picking stuff up and putting it in trucks because we're sort of the last piece of that puzzle in these situations. And that's what people see, and they may, you know, make assumptions about how that happened. I think, you know, we all share the same goals, which is that we want to get people shelter. That's why I think that's been the hallmark of the mayor's agenda is housing. We support that. You know, we have no desire to enforce, you know, cleaning things up if people don't have a place to go. So I think we all should be trying to work together to do things in the best, most compassionate and empathetic way possible. But you know, I would say that we're doing our best with HSOC and we clean after folks have moved in to try to offer those services.
And Carla, I wanted to ask you about expectations for keeping the streets clean. And a Department of Public Works spokesperson recently said that the department is trying to change the culture of the city so that residents take more responsibility for keeping the streets clean. But what do you say to those who argue that people in San Francisco are paying taxes and fees, so it really should be the city that does that job?
It always makes me think, I don't know if you're a Glee fan, but there was a great Glee episode where Sue says you should litter more because your tax dollars pay to clean up the litter. I think, you know, we should strike a reasonable balance, right? I don't think we should be encouraging people to litter because it's the city's job to clean it up. We should all be doing our best to keep the city clean so that we can use the limited resources that we have in the best way possible. So I always think about the mayor who talks about how her grandmother made her get up and sweep the street on the weekends. And that really instilled in her a sense of civic pride and a desire to participate in making the city a better place. I think there are benefits beyond helping to keep the streets clean. If we all kind of embrace that role of civic pride, I think we can all help each other out.
I believe in that. I wish I could have gotten my broom out and got rid of the Dodgers. Like, that's how strongly I feel about sweeping.
Atlanta's trying.
They're doing a good job, I think. Well, critical to keep the effort to keep streets clean is having enough trash cans. And DPW has proposed designing a new trash can, and the cost of those cans or those prototypes has been quoted as up to $20,000 per can. The Board of Supervisors balked at that proposal. Supervisor Matt Haney has asked the department, why can't it use an off-the-shelf can? So what's your response to that? And tell us a little bit more about the odyssey of the San Francisco trash can.
It's a bit of an odyssey, but we're closing in on the end of it. I think, you know, I know firsthand dealing with my colleagues who are in the street cleaning team, just how challenging it is to be a trash can on the streets of San Francisco. I always used to say, you know, we have a tough love approach for our street trees. We plant them and then they have to be tough in order to survive as a street tree. And it's fairly similar for trash cans. They take a lot of abuse. So we need a can that can stand up to a lot of people rifling through it, or people trying to rifle through it. The locks on our cans get broken all the time. So there are a lot of things that our cans are sort of have to face that we are trying to correct. Because, you know, the example that came up at the top of the show was about litter in the streets. And one of the challenges we have is people rifle through the trash cans, maybe looking for recycling or for something else. And then they pull as they go, and that generates litter that then blows around the city. So our new can needs to be able to do a number of things. We need it to be really tamper proof so that people can't break into it in order to rifle through it. We need it to be rifle through proof, for lack of a better term. I don't know what the right term for that is. We also need it to be reasonably easy to empty for our garbage service. And so there are a lot of things that it needs to do. And ideally, it also can handle a sensor that allows us to know when the can is full, which will make servicing the can a lot more efficient so that we're not wasting time driving to empty cans. And then if cans are filling up more often, we know that we can send people there to address them. We absolutely are testing some off-the-shelf models. We've done this for a long time, and we haven't found a good off-the-shelf model. We've tested them in other places. So part of our pilot will include testing some additional off-the-shelf models, but we are also working with an industrial design firm to try to come up with a can that will be all things to all people, or at least be the best possible trash can for the needs of our city.
Well, I just wanted to follow up on that one because I knew you were going to be on. And so I started looking at trash cans around the city. And there's a trash can called the Renaissance Can, I think. Is that the one that has like the recycling on top and then trash below? And I'm just curious, why was that a design? Because that just seems to be one of the more challenging trash cans. Because I've seen other kinds, too, that are just like concrete blocks with bins inside.
Yeah, so the Renaissance Can was, I don't know how it was chosen, but I can tell you that it is a can that we see in other places too. There's a similar can in other cities in the Bay. I think the main goal originally for that can was to have a place to keep the recycling separate. Mm-hmm. That's obviously a desire of the city and of many of our residents and visitors. They want a place to be able to recycle. But the challenge was that it then, you know, the recycling bin would sometimes break and then it falls in the can anyway. And then people are still, not everybody's recycling appropriately. So people are still reaching in. So, you know, I think that this is one of the challenges that we see with some of the off the shelf models is you address one problem, you know, making recycling available and accessible, and you might create an additional problem. So by trying to identify all the needs that we have and working with a designer, we're really hoping we can have a can that will fix as many of those problems as possible.
Well, I think that's about as in-depth as we've ever gotten into trash cans on State of the Bay. So really a lot to unpack there. So I'm glad we covered it. But I did want to move on to potholes. And that's a big issue that a lot of residents have to deal with. And I know the department says you can call 311, that you described earlier, to get a pothole filled, but that it may not be the agency's responsibility. But we know there's a lot of frustration out there. We have an email from Richard who says the state of the roads in San Francisco makes it seem like this is not a world-class city. Streets here get patched over and then patched again if they are fixed at all. I literally broke an axle on my car because of a pothole. And of course, the city was no help at all about it. With a $6 billion budget, why can't we get these problems fixed? Why can't we pave the streets regularly? So, Carla, I'm sure that's another type of comment that you get a lot. What's your response?
Yeah, I know that it can be very frustrating to hit a pothole. I have experienced that. I will say that actually our pavement condition index, our PCI score, has been steadily going up. If you are driving down the street and seeing that same pothole, it may not feel like that. But in fact, we have been, since the last general obligation bond was passed to fund paving, we've actually made great strides in increasing our pavement condition index score. So it's gone up. We do sometimes have to repair the same thing over and over again. A lot of times it may not be an actual pothole, but it could be a sinkhole, which means Yikes. There's an underlying issue, right? And that's part of the challenge because that's a bigger fix that may need to address something going on under the roadway. Oftentimes, if there's a sewer problem, that creates that sinkhole. And so it's not quite as quick and easy as fixing a pothole. So, you know, as with anything, we want to get better. We want to improve. But the roads actually have been improving. I mean, when we look at them from that pavement condition index, we are seeing steady improvement. And we would, you know, love to continue to increase those scores. For potholes, we do try to respond to 311 requests within 72 hours. And, you know, we don't get to every single one within 72 hours, but we are pretty consistently getting back to them. So I know it feels like you're calling the same thing over and over again sometimes. But I would still encourage people to call, because if we continue to go to the same spot, then we try to prioritize that for the larger repair. Hmm.
Is there any money in the infrastructure bill that's been going through Congress that you guys are expecting or hoping to get? And what would you use that money for?
I think everyone has their eyes on the infrastructure bill for sure. I mean, certainly I think we would hope that we would get some funding for some of the capital improvement projects that are going on in the city. I'll put in another plug for street trees. We are really hopeful we might get some planting money to increase our tree canopy and actually grow the urban forest in a more equitable way. That's a goal. I think, you know, we've identified a number of quote unquote shovel ready projects that could really happen right away if the infrastructure money does flow to us. So those include anything from, you know, improving roadways, paving, to actually developing, you know, new streetscaped projects. So we've got a nice long list of projects that we could really drop right away into action if we get some of the infrastructure funding.
Well, let's talk about trees since you are the former arborist. We have a comment from a listener who asks, a tree fell over on our block and Public Works was quick to chop it up and clear the roadway. But now the sidewalk is buckled. The city says it's the responsibility of the property owner to fix the sidewalk, even though the tree is the city's responsibility. The property owner can't seem to afford to fix the sidewalk. We're at a stalemate. Shouldn't the city pick up the tab for something like this?
Yes, if it is in fact as described, it is our responsibility. So, you know, if the caller wants to send me an email with that location, I can look into it. If this, okay. If the tree caused the damage, or if the tree's failure caused the damage, then it is now covered by our Street Tree SF program, which gave us responsibility for all the trees in the public right of way after Prop E of 2016 was passed. So we would be on the hook. If it's not tree related damage, then it is the property owner's responsibility to repair. So, you know, if we did, we just have to see, but if as described, it was due to the tree's failure, then that would be our responsibility to fix.
Good to know.
All right. Well, let's talk about some of the public works projects that are going on around the city. And a pain point for many is the Van Ness corridor that a lot of people have nicknamed Van Mess as the bus rapid transit lane is going in there. And that's a project that's taken a very long time. I mean, voters originally approved the funding for that back in 2003, and it's still not delivered. It's $37 million over budget. Of course, it's being run by San Francisco MTA, not the Department of Public Works. But do you think if the department had been in charge that we might have been better off with this project?
Well, you know, that's a complicated project for sure. But I will say that I think Public Works has a long history of delivering complicated projects. You know, as I described at the beginning of the show, we deal with lots of capital projects. So, you know, it's a difficult corridor. I think we have demonstrated we've delivered other capital projects that could be similar, like the Geary Bus Rapid Transit project. We delivered pretty successfully. We've also delivered, you know, a new streetscape project on Jefferson Street that we started and during the pandemic, and we're opening up just later this week. So, you know, I want to say that we would do a great job delivering that project.
Well, city projects aren't not a new thing, and a lot of them have overruns and some of them have delays. But do you think that those delays and overruns are tied to the way the city has in the past done business? I mean, will fresh leadership like yours change the outlook for projects like these?
Well, I think a lot of the delays are due to complicated underground utilities. You know, San Francisco has a lot of infrastructure under the ground. So I don't think that we can blame delays of capital projects on, you know, the head of any given department, honestly. I think what we are working towards in San Francisco, in San Francisco Public Works is really, you know, trying to make sure that our employees have the best possible training and resources and foresight to try to anticipate challenges and plan for them in order to minimize delays. But, you know, there's no perfect project. I think you'll always be able to point to something that you wished hadn't happened. Anyone who's ever gone through a renovation, I think, knows that there's always some unexpected thing. But our goal is that we try to anticipate as many of those as possible and identify risks if we can't anticipate, or if we don't know what's happening in a certain place. We try to identify what are the risks that might be associated and try to plan for those. I think the challenge we face is there's a lot of pressure to make things happen more quickly. And so when we want to be realistic about, hey, this is a challenge, we've got to anticipate, this is going to take time, people are like, do it more quickly. And then that might end up compounding an issue.
And Carla, following up on your referencing the Geary Street project, we did get a listener question about this. Tim writes in to ask or to say, I'm not a fan of the way Geary and California streets have been redesigned for buses. California Street has become a parking lot because Lake is now a slow street. I've been told that the time for public comment on these projects has closed. Shouldn't the city do a better job of letting residents, renters and homeowners and business folks know about projects that will impact them? I don't live on California, but I use it regularly for a commute. So thoughts in response to Tim's comment there?
Yeah, well, I'm sorry to hear that he doesn't like the design. I think that that is definitely one of the things that we try really hard to do is a lot of outreach when we have a project early in the design phase. So there may be opportunities for feedback. I would encourage Tim and any of your listeners to check our website because we always put notices up on the website if we have a project that's coming up, if we're going to have community meetings. We typically will have multiple community meetings as a project's being designed to try to get that feedback from folks and try to ensure that, you know, the challenge I think is if you don't live on a street, you may not be seeing all the notices that we've been placing about, you know, an upcoming project. But we do keep our website up to date. If people are interested, they can always check there. If you know of an area where you're going to be spending a lot of time, it might be worth checking that.
I think nextdoor.com seems to be like the hotbed of neighborhood unrest. So probably check there too. With the minute we have left, Carla, what are some big priorities for you or things that you're looking forward to in this job?
Well, I mean, I think my big priority is trying to provide kind of a stable presence here in the department and as much as possible, continuing to try to work on improving morale and, you know, really reminding we can't seem to get away from the quote unquote Nehru scandal. But I think those of us who work here would really like to just put it behind us and do our jobs. I think so. My main goal would be, you know, try to be as steady as possible and let the employees know that they are valued. And I think many residents, we hear wonderful things from the residents all the time about appreciating the work that we do. We're a very visible city in the department. We're a very visible department in the city. And so I think we also tend to get a lot of complaints from folks. And so I think my goal would be, you know, remind everyone, our employees and the public, that we're working hard for the city. We want the city to be as the best that it can be. And I guess that would be my goal.
Well, thank you so much for joining us, Carla Short. She's the interim director of the Department of Public Works. And if you want to reach out to the department, as she said, there's a pretty vibrant website. You want to give us the website address, Carla?
Sure. It's sfpublicworks.org, all one word.
Super. Well, thanks again for joining us on State of the Bay.
Thanks so much for having me.
And coming up after the break, we'll hear Grace's interview with local musician La Donya. Stay with us.
Welcome back to State at the Bay. I'm Grace Wan with Ethan Elkind. Recently, I had a chance to sit down with San Francisco native La Donya. She's a musician who brings a vibrant blend of reggaeton, Bay Area hip-hop, and traditional Mexican and Latin American music to her listeners. She's a singer with a swagger, and her enthusiasm for her music is infectious. Let's take a listen. La Donya, welcome to State of the Bay. Your music is amazing. I've been listening to it all morning and rocking out. It's a mix of so many different genres. Tell us about your influences.
Yeah, I grew up in a very musical household. We played music together as a family band, La Familia Peña Gouveia, and we played a lot of regional Mexican music, so rancheras, boleros, sones, a lot of the different styles that you see captured throughout conjunto, norteño, and mariachi aggregations. But we also played a lot of other types of Afro Caribeño music, right? Like merengue and salsa and cumbia, you know, coming from Colombia. And the reason for that was that both my sister, Renee Peña Gouveia, and my father, Miguel Gouveia, play the diatonic button accordion. So we had a lot of different genres and you know, cultures to borrow from with that instrumentation. But on top of that, I also like to talk about my mother's influence. She started playing music as part of the folk revival movement. And we had a lot of American roots music, folk, blues, old time in the house. And we like to incorporate, you know, those roots as well, and country, you know, the Bakersfield sound. My dad's from Bakersfield. So we had a lot going on. It's essentially country music. It's the people's music. And so our audience, you know, was very diverse. And so we had a lot of different styles to pull out for them and get everybody dancing, get everybody jamming along with us.
Your influences are many, and it's a good thing that you were musical growing up in such a musical family. It would be a bummer if you weren't good at it. But you've actually created your own genre as well, and you call it femmeton. Can you explain what that is and how it came to be?
It is a femme narrative. You know, as a young queer woman of color, you don't really see a lot of representation throughout the pop canon in general, but also throughout reggaeton and contemporary Latin music. So I just really wanted to make explicit that that was important to the sound, that was important to the practice, and important to me as an artist. So yeah, that's kind of the basis behind femmeton. But whenever I talk about femmeton, I also do like to complicate it a little bit and saying that femmeton doesn't obscure the roots of reggae and reggaeton.
What's your songwriting process like?
I grew up watching my dad. I really consider him to be a master arranger. So he would take songs, listen to songs, and write out charts. And he paid very special attention to the role that each instrument was playing, to the flow of the song, to having flexibility within that, right? If your audience is like getting down, like having a really good time, then you want to draw out that party part of the song, right? So obviously I'm a lyricist. Obviously I write all my own melodies, but I think that the form of the song is one of the most important aspects. So I love to start with, you know, a beautiful, important melody and lyric, something that will capture your audience's attention, but also be very sonically interesting. I love to use acoustic instruments, especially with the more contemporary digital synthetic beat production that a lot of my music is based in. I think it's very important to continue to, you know, kind of amalgamate with that new style, the folk traditions that I came out of. In most of my songs, we have a very important part that I call the descarga, right? Descarga in Spanish means to let go. And it's, you know, following the tighter form of the melody and the story. And then you get to the part of the song where it's time to dance. It's time to have fun. It's also the part of the song that really draws in audience participation. You have a coro, right? A refrain that everybody, even if you don't speak Spanish, you can kind of start to pick out words and sing along. And it's simple and fun enough that everybody kind of becomes more involved with the song. So that part of the music is really important to me. But I definitely would say that I approach it from an arranger's perspective.
What's a coro that you just love, that you're just like, that just hit it?
Well, when we're talking about, you know, simplicity of coro and accessibility to a bilingual or English speaking, whatever the language might be, I think definitely always I think about Memorias Caramelas. Because the coro at the end is que va, te quiero, papa, que va, que no aguanto más, which is basically like, I love you so much, and I can't keep doing this, right? Like, I can't, no aguanto más, I can't keep doing this. But it's so joyous, and it's for me, it's such a release, especially when it goes into the a cappella moment where it's all voices, all harmonies. I definitely really love when I see my audience singing along at that part. It, you know, it almost brings me to tears.
Talking about your musical education, it seems like growing up in San Francisco, you were able to get some, not just with your family, but through school. Mm-hmm. What do you see in public schools with musical education?
Oh, well, the first program I want to talk about is the SFUSD's Mariachi program. We have so many beautiful, amazing music educators as part of that program. And I did get some really good lessons in school. You know, unfortunately, in my middle school, we didn't have a music program at all, you know, so that we could get remedial math and English. But I was able to go to School of the Arts, and I had a really amazing teacher there, Melesio Magdaluyo, who taught me about Latin jazz, who taught me about big band. But I would say that for the most part, I didn't have access to the type of education that we're giving our kids today through the mariachi program, which is culturally relevant, not Eurocentric, just extremely interesting and multifaceted arts education through the cultural practice of mariachi music. And, you know, this isn't just for my Latinx students. This isn't just for my kids with a Mexican background. This is for everybody. Everybody is benefiting and feeling a deep connection to this music. You know, I have students who are migrants from Cambodia and from Thailand and from all over the place, and they're singing their hearts out. Like, I almost want to cry right now because they have such a deep connection to it. Even if they don't know exactly what they're singing, they find a deep connection to it. And I think that that is felt because, you know, even as kids, we're tired of Eurocentric music. We're tired of studying Bach. We're tired of the folkiest access of us having is hot cross buns. Like, that's not appropriate. That's not relevant. And it's not interesting. And even as children, you think, oh no, something simple, Mother Goose. No, it's not interesting. So to bring in more interesting, more relevant, more just vivacious music to the classroom, it really affects all of my students in a really awesome way. So I think the mariachi program is a beautiful example of how it is possible to learn theory, to learn theoretical components of music and history and the diasporic nature of music without it being all about the classical music that we all start out learning.
Yeah. Well, where can we catch you live next? And what's it like at a live show for La Doña?
Well, my live shows are really fun. I love seeing people dancing and singing along. My favorite part is that listeners of so many different backgrounds. I love that my shows are intergenerational. I love that everybody has a different favorite song. It's something for everybody. And so I love for my shows to really present a lot of different musical traditions. And we will be playing at the DeYoung Gala on November 5th. And then we will be playing the following week. I'll be having a vinyl release at Amoeba Records. That's on the 12th of November. And then on the 17th, which is a show I'm really excited about, we'll be playing at KQED's new concert space and doing a concert interview hybrid show. But yeah, that's all we have coming up.
And I want to wish you the best of luck. And La Doña, thanks for being on State of the Bay.
Thank you so much, Grace. A pleasure talking to you. Barrio compuesto de
nube, nube, la casa Dios. Well, that's State of the Bay this week.
We want to thank all of our guests and listeners this evening for being part of the conversation.
For more information about this and other State of the Bay shows, visit the State of the Bay page on KALW.org.
And if you have any questions or comments about anything you heard tonight, let us know. Email us at any time at stateofthebay@KALW.org.
So, Grace, what are you looking forward to for next week's show?
Well, I'm actually looking forward to Atlanta sweeping the Dodgers, but on our next show, we're going to be talking about why the rates of eating disorders are rising among Bay Area teens and whether social media is to blame.
All right, we'll have to keep an eye on both that and baseball, but tonight's show was produced by Grace Wan and Wendy Holcomb. It was engineered by David Kwan, and D Minor was our board operator.
Good night, and thanks for joining us on State of the Bay.